Hey, Bill and Gutton, welcome to Black Law Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you. Today we're going to travel across the seas to look at treaties, reconciliation and Indigenous history in Canada. This is a television program that was recorded a few years ago, but it's very similar to the conversations that are being had in New Zealand and in the Commonwealth of Australia. So today we're going to have a listen to this, Treaties, Reconciliation and Indigenous History in Canada. Enjoy.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our live discussion. Onkodons Indigenous, Mayinga Nedodem, Chippewas of Georgina Island, and Dunjibwa, Anishinaabe and Dau. Hi, I'm Duncan McHugh. I'm the host of CBC Radio's Cross Country Checkup and a reporter on CBC The National. Every week, we're talking about different aspects of Canada and our past. Tonight, we're talking about Indigenous history. We'll be looking at treaties, reconciliation, and more. And we want to hear from you. Leave comments and ask questions. We've got a team of producers monitoring Facebook and YouTube, so we can get your voice onto the panel as well. Certainly, the story of us has sparked a lot of conversation, but we really tonight, we want to go beyond that and show and tell more stories about Canadian history. It's an opportunity to look at Indigenous history, how much we know and don't know. Joining us tonight from Calgary, Eldon Yellowhorn is the archaeologist and chair of First Nation Studies at Simon Fraser University from Thunder Bay. Cynthia Wesley Eskima is the Indigenous chair of Truth and Reconciliation at Lakehead University. And here in our studio, Rye Morin, director of National Center for Truth and Reconciliation at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. Rye, if I could start with you. In your experience, how much does the average Canadian know about Indigenous history?
I would say not very much, really, when it comes right down to it. We have stats to back that up and lots of anecdotes. So let's talk about the stats first. Last year, we collaborated with a number of other organizations on a national poll surveying perceptions of Indigenous peoples by non-Indigenous peoples. And we asked people, have you heard or read anything about residential schools? Have you heard of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission? 66% had heard of residential schools. 40% had heard about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. When we probed and pushed people a little bit harder to say, okay, what is it they actually know? Actual understanding falls right off. So that's the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and residential schools. That doesn't even begin to scratch the surface on the 60 scoop, treaties, traditional ways of knowing and being, Indigenous worldviews, the list goes on. So we got a long ways to go. But, you know, on the positive side of things, what I am seeing across the country is a lot of people trying really hard. And we are seeing some pretty impressive shifts, I think, in people trying to bring this into schools and into curriculum.
And so I want to pick up on the curriculum point. But Professor Yellowhorn, if I could turn to you, if you had to give the average Canadian a grade on their knowledge of Indigenous history, what grade would you give the average Canadian?
C minus would be my grade.
Why?
Primarily because there's just not a lot of information that has been disseminated or taken in. I regularly teach courses at my campus, and the assignments that I give to students, such as where do you find Indigenous presence in your community, and many of them discover for the first time that they live right next door to an Indian reserve.
Are we doing a good job as a country of telling a full history of our country?
I would say no, primarily because the past has been the story of Canada, but not necessarily the story of Indigenous people in Canada.
Cynthia, if I could throw to you, Eldon talked about talking with his students. How are we integrating Indigenous history into curriculums? Let's start with at a post-secondary level where you're working right now.
Well, at a post-secondary level, you know, the presidents of universities across Canada have put together some principles, 13 principles that say, yes, we're going to, you know, do our level best to integrate this. And they've had that in place for a couple of years now. Places like Lakehead have Indigenous content requirements so that they're trying very hard to slowly, you know, build up what their student body knows about Indigenous people. We've got 75,000 Indigenous people living around Lakehead up here in northwestern Ontario, and lots of people are doing their level best to understand it. Lots of people are asking for curriculum in their high schools, in their universities, and I speak to people outside of the university as well as inside, so I get an opportunity to understand how the public perceives the question of curriculum development and education. And frankly, I think there's a pretty good desire, basically out of the TRC process, to do with it what they can to learn more.
Cynthia, let me ask you this question. I know when I went to university that I was shocked, I was surprised at how much I needed to learn about the Indian Act, for example. And then when I went on to law school, there was even more that I learned about treaty and so many different aspects of Canadian history that I didn't certainly learn in high school. How much do Canadian Indigenous people know about their own history?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's a big, challenging question. A lot of the history of our own communities got buried, lost, put aside through the Indian residential school period, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000 scoop of kids out of our communities. And there's been a lot of pressure on Indigenous peoples to survive, to, you know, to be able to hold their traditions together in as much a positive way as possible. So lots of kids don't know that much about their history. Some of those kids don't really know why they're living on reserves. They don't know why they can't speak the language. And they need to know a little bit more about the intergenerational effect as well, that legacy piece. I'm always talking about that legacy piece. And we're kind of up against a hard wall there. But the kids want to know. And I feel good about that. I think that we have a job to do ourselves to ensure that those kids have that opportunity. And it may not be within the confines of a university system. Mm. It may be really in a community itself. And I think that we're all under an obligation here to do as much mentoring as we possibly can with the kids that we have access to, and maybe even online.
Ryan Moran, I wouldn't mind asking you that question as well, because I know I followed you around for 4 days at the Truth and Reconciliation hearing in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you mentioned was as a Métis male that you were coming to terms with the history that you were learning. How much do Canadian Indigenous people or Indigenous people in Canada know about our own history?
I think it's a really good question, Duncan. And I think, you know, it depends. On the one hand, we are so blessed to have some incredible elders still in this country. And that is in light of the very systemic attempts, long-term attempts to eradicate that knowledge from this country. So we've got knowledge keepers. We've got people that know the old ways, know the songs, know the ceremonies, and really the roots of all of that. So we can be really thankful for that. But a lot has been lost. And the education system just generally has been inherently assimilative. So Indigenous perspectives on history, Indigenous ways of knowing and being just simply don't appear in the curriculum. So Canada as a whole, I believe, has a very significant knowledge gap. You know, and you asked me about myself. I mean, the further I go along my journey, the more time I spend with the elders, the more I recognize just how little I know. And that's where when you go to the elders and they say, you know, you're learning right to the very last days of your life.
What have you learned about your Métis heritage that you didn't know initially?
Well, boy, there's a whole bunch of things. I think where I'm at personally right now is I'm reaching back further and really understanding that, yes, Métis peoples are combined peoples, but reaching as far back as I can to the roots of my Indigenous self, and really understanding that and unpacking that and underpacking all the ceremonial responsibilities and the ways of seeing the world that are so important there. But at the same time, I'm also really, I think, starting to try and understand my non-Indigenous side as well. Like, you know, over Christmas, I was reading a lot about my Scottish side and where my family came from in Scotland, and understanding actually in that in many ways, there's a system of oppression that runs across the world that my Scottish ancestors actually fell under as well. You know, they were victims of colonization as well. It's certainly different than what happened here in Canada, but there was a process there. So I think, you know, self-discovery, learning from the elders, reflecting on who I am and also what my responsibilities are as an Indigenous person to teach my children, you know, and to pass that knowledge on. And that's a place where, you know, when I go to teach, sometimes I realize how much I don't know.
Eldon, if I could draw you into this question as well, because Rye raises a really good point about the knowledge keepers, and there have been some incredible people in our communities that have managed to keep the culture and the traditions alive. But if we're talking about history, I wonder what your experience has been in the prairies of the passing on of oral history and that deep past of Indigenous history to our own people.
Well, that's certainly my concern, being an archaeologist, and I have to say now, becoming an elderly man myself, you know, that history itself, we can go beyond oral history, we can go beyond written history, and using archaeological techniques, we can start to look for the roots of Blackfoot culture, for example, in the archaeological record. For example, some of our sacred ceremonies, say the beaver medicine bundle, I can now confidently state that that's been in Blackfoot culture for at least 1,100 years because I've been able to study its signature in the archaeological record. I can also talk about the invention of the buffalo jump, because people just assume that the buffalo jump was always there for our ancestors, but no, it was actually invented at a very specific point in time. And by looking at Blackfoot oral narratives and looking at my own research in archaeology and archaeoastronomy, I've been able to put it at a very confident date at about 2,500 years ago. But there are other traditions. For example, long before we had tobacco, people had already started smoking as a habit. So smoking existed in Blackfoot culture for about 5,000 years before tobacco came into the culture. So looking at these sorts of traits in the archaeological record, I can look at deep time and look at the roots of Blackfoot culture way beyond oral narratives and beyond the written record.
Eldon, did they have any good strategies for quitting?
I'm afraid not. they've had 5,000 years of practicing and they still haven't quit.
Cynthia, one of the great things about doing our Facebook Lives is that we get to involve our audience, and so we've already got lots of questions coming in. Cynthia, if I could bring you into this conversation with a question that we got from Michael. What do you suggest would be a good way to bring history into the classroom? As a teacher, I've been trying, but it's finding authentic resources and having truthful history. Please suggest. Cynthia, why don't you take a go at that?
Well, one of the things is to actually get into a relationship with the very people living around you and invite them into your classroom so that they can talk about, you know, the worldview. They can talk about the history as they know and see it. They can bring artifacts into the classroom. They can take them out to the land, which is a very important way to teach. They can take them out to some of the local repositories of artifacts that you were already talking about just earlier. There's lots of things that you can do, and I think that we need to think about that. Guest lecturers, and bringing people into the classroom so that your students can see Indigenous peoples from many walks of life. Because there's still, one of the things we're up against when we talk about history is stereotypes, biases, beliefs that get in the way of actually understanding the Indigenous culture and only seeing it through a very narrow lens. And so what you want to do is you want to bring in Indigenous people from every walk of life, including elders and policemen and all those things, so that people can see that we have not only have a fulsome history, we also have a very fulsome contemporary life that is very much influencing the rest of Canada.
I teach a course at the University of British Columbia called Reporting in Indigenous Communities, and I know that when we bring community members into the class, it's one of the highlights for the students in terms of really connecting with people. But I wonder, Cynthia, if you could give any recommendations, if this history teacher is wanting to bring people into his classroom or to go out on the land, do you have any recommendations on how to do that? Are there protocols that could or should be followed?
Well, I think that you have to be in touch with the people that are in charge of the places where you go. So if you want to go to the local Friendship Center, give a call to the director, the executive director, and see if it's possible for them to visit the Friendship Center. If you want to go to a First Nation community that's close by, give a call to the education director or to the chief and council and go and actually see them in person. Don't send a letter or make a phone call. Go actually out there and see them. Maybe take a couple students with you. But a relationship is not something that you do over paper. It's something that you actually do in person. And bring some gifts, some coffee, some tea, you know, something that you can share. And say, you know, we'd really like to know a little bit more about what's going on over here. And we'd like to have you come to our school and we'd like to bring our classroom up. People in communities, because I've done this for years with the Canadian Roots Exchange, they love having students come out. They are so pleased when young people and teachers are interested in learning something about the culture, learning something about the language, the history, and what's important to Indigenous peoples today.
Eldon, do you want to weigh in on giving some advice to this history teacher who wants, is really interested in trying to incorporate Indigenous history into his classroom, how he might go about doing that?
Well, I would be biased in terms of saying archaeology offers a very good and kind of a vibrant way of interacting with material culture and certainly bringing firsthand perspectives from people adds to that and enhances that interaction.
If let's go to our next comment from Facebook. Harvey Michelle sent in a note saying, the history that's taught in schools must be rewritten from an Indigenous perspective. Education is a provincial jurisdiction. In the spirit of reconciliation, an action should be implemented. Mm. That sounds like a question for Ry Moran. What do you think of that comment?
I think that's exactly right. You know, why are we having this conversation tonight? We were talking about, you know, the television series and how Indigenous peoples are framed in that. And precisely how Indigenous peoples are framed in any conversation really strikes at the heart of reconciliation. So if authentic Indigenous voices aren't coming up, and if Indigenous perspectives on Canadian history aren't being told, there are some very significant gaps in our understanding, because Indigenous peoples have largely been excluded from Canada, and Indigenous voices have largely been excluded from our history books. So it's really important as we move forward as a country that we understand who we're listening to when we listen. And when we listen to the wrong sources, all sorts of bias creeps in.
What's an example of a wrong source?
Well, you know, I think it's quite possible. If you go and take a book, you can write you can read a book that is, you know, citation upon citation upon citation upon citation without ever having had a conversation with an Indigenous person, you know? So knowledge ends up becoming stacked. We have told ourselves many myths about Indigenous peoples in this country as well for a very long period of time. And what hasn't happened is asking Indigenous peoples what their actual perspectives are. So, you know, to the previous question about where do you find this information? Well, you know, we've had a number of big commissions in this country. I mean, the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, I mean, they interviewed thousands of people. You know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission interviewed thousands of people. The Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Inquiry is going to interview a whole bunch more. Aboriginal Justice Inquiry, you know. There are lots of very good records of Indigenous peoples available. It's just a matter, oftentimes, of either reaching out to them or not reaching out to them.
The last commenter on Facebook there mentioned reconciliation. Cynthia, you're a chair of reconciliation. Can you remind us what the TRC was and why it was important from a historical perspective?
Well, the TRC was put in place to actually hear the voices, just what Ry Moran is just talking about, to hear the voices of those adults who were once children who went to residential school, to give them an opportunity to tell their stories to Canada, the truth of what happened there. And the reconciliation part, I think, comes from the fact that people would take the time to listen to those stories and not only believe them, but understand that they happened and it has affected the entire history of this country. So reconciliation will come out of that understanding, that acceptance that this country has made some fundamental mistakes and some grievous errors when it's dealt with the Indigenous population. And that was what it was all about. And I think they took 7,000, a little over 7,000 testimonials from people across the country that went to those schools. And they took a lot of other testimonials from other places. Obviously, there was an independent assessment process as well. So we have a lot of work to do when it comes to making good, not just saying sorry, but attaching some action to that whole question, that whole, you know, conversation that makes it proper, that makes it good for Indigenous peoples and equalizes that relationship in a good way.
If our conversation is about understanding history, though, I'm wondering, Eldon Yellowhorn, do you think the impact of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in terms of understanding Indigenous history in this country?
Well, history is, contrary to popular belief, it's not set in stone. In fact, it's a good thing to go back and revise it on a regular basis, because you come up to new perspectives, new discoveries, or new sources, and each of these will add a different element to the story that's already in existence. So historical revisionism, it's an ongoing process. You know, we have to carry on and work with what we have. And as new information, new methods appear for us. We have to take advantage of those and help bring a fuller story to the past.
You mentioned a term, Eldon, historical revisionism. We did a show on Cross Country Checkup a couple weeks ago about asking the question, should we change the names of monuments and street signs that carry some of Canada's colonial history? And this was a theme that came up with a number of callers, that they were concerned about historical revisionism. I wonder, Rye, what you would think when you hear somebody say that they're concerned that bringing Indigenous history into the narrative in a way that it hasn't been in the past, that it's been missing, is somehow revising or Canada's history.
Well, I think about something that Senator Murray Sinclair says, and he says that while we can't change the past, what happened, we can change our understanding and our knowledge of it and our response to it. So as we go out and we look at all of these places that we've named in this country, each one of those names is there for a very real reason. And there's a whole set of information that's attached to that. So I think our challenge right now as a country is unpacking all of this stuff that we kind of drag around with us as a country, like, you know, Canada, right? Manitoba. Where did these words come from? And starting to unpack these and also understanding, you know, who, you know, Langevin was and Ryerson and, you know, Duncan Campbell Scott. Who are these other names that roll off our tongue? What are they responsible for? And where did they take us to?
Cynthia, earlier on you mentioned the 60s scoop, and we've got a comment here from Bill Stewart on Facebook who says, as a 60s scoop survivor, I was denied the knowledge and traditions of my heritage. I still have so much to learn to regain. When you hear a comment like that, Cynthia, what goes through your head?
Well, I've heard it so many times because as an educator, of course, I get lots of students coming into my class who are 60s scooped students, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000. It hasn't stopped. The whole idea of taking children away from their families, their communities, their nations, and giving them another kind of an experience is still ongoing. And I feel a lot of frustration about that because those kids and now adults deserve to have that knowledge. They deserve to have that recompense. Somehow they need to be able to be given back what was taken so rudely away from them. And it's still happening. And I think that's really the tragedy here is that we look at it, you know, we look at history and we say, well, it happened then, there's nothing we can do about it. We're still creating that history every moment of our lives. And in those moments of our lives today, we're continuing that same kind of thievery of these, of all of these people's understandings, knowledge, culture, languages, and experiences. And I think we have an obligation as a country to stop doing that and understand that we have something to do for those young people and for those adults.
Rachel A. Michinin wrote in a comment, learning about the treaties will help address misconceptions people have about Indigenous people. The learning has to include the historical relationship and how it connects to current realities and issues. So that's a good jumping off point. Let's get into some specifics. Eldon Yellowhorn, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation. Last week's episode of The Story of Us included a segment about Treaty 6. Can you tell us a little bit about Treaty 6 and why that was important?
Well, it's part of Canada's nation-building efforts. Because what people have to understand is that these treaties were created specifically for Canada's nation-building efforts. When British Columbia signed on to become part of the Canadian Federation, one of the stipulations was that there was going to be a fixed link between the older provinces and British Columbia. And in between Upper Canada and British Columbia was this whole tract of land that was still burdened with Aboriginal title. So that was the whole purpose of the number of treaties, Treaty 6, you can take whichever one, but each one of those treaties was specifically intended to remove the burden of Indian title so that Canada could have clear title to this land that they were now claiming.
One of the things that strikes me when I hear the conversation about treaties in this country is that it's almost the tale of two stories. And the courts have wrestled with this. There is the written document, and then there is the Indigenous understanding of what the treaties mean. And Eldon, can you give us a sense of what the Indigenous perspective on the treaties mean and why they're so important even today?
Well, in very many respects, the Native people, they were very aware of what was going on around them. They understood that things were changing. For example, all the people on the plains could see that every year there were fewer and fewer bison running around, and that was the mainstay of their economies. So when the treaties were being negotiated, there was a real sense in their terms that they were entering this partnership in order to give themselves a chance at a future. And they could see that the old ways that were that they were part of their ancestors' life ways were going into the past. They were not going to be viable anymore. So this was an opportunity for them to embark on a new way of living, a new life, but in a partnership with a greater power that was moving in on their country.
Cynthia Wesley-Eskima, if I could, the Supreme Court of Canada has said that it's important that treaties are interpreted with the spirit and intent of the negotiations at the time, and trying to get in and weigh all of the evidence, both oral history and the written record. I'm wondering when people may be puzzled when they hear that you know, the great Cree leader Harold Cardinal described treaties as Indian Magna Carta. Why is it for Canadians who are struggling with why those documents, those that were signed in the late 1800s, continue to be so important to those First Nations who have signed and are treaty nations now? Why are they still so important?
I think we need to go back a little further than that, because the first treaties that were actually put together were not land cession treaties. That didn't occur till 1850. The first treaties were peace and friendship treaties. And the whole idea behind them was, again, the relationship and the whole way, how will we work together? How will we share the lands? How will the resources be shared? How will we guarantee that our people are protected and their interests are preserved, and they know what, and you know, they know what's going to be coming their way? The chiefs at the time, you know, it wasn't for them about, you know, keeping people out or bringing people in. It was just about, how do we protect our own people to ensure that they're all right? So I think we got to go back to that, and we got to look at the kind of framework of the treaties. Like when we look at the dish with one spoon, or when we look at the Guswenta, you know, and we look at all of those types of treaties, they said something very clear. They said, we're all in this together, and we want to ensure that our people are going to be fine. So even with the two-row wampum, where it says, you know, we're going to be in two separate ships here, our canoe and your ship, they're framed in peace, friendship, and respect. You know, they're framed in ways that said, we need to do this properly. And I think that the Canadian population at large needs to understand that first, before they start to try to understand the legalities of it and how those treaties still stand today. The elders are very clear that they are sacred documents, that they hold the relationship and the value of the lands, and they are important, and they're not going to go away. And because they're old doesn't mean that they're no longer relevant. They remain relevant. And that spirit and intent is about, you know, the intention behind the treaties may not have been so great from the Western side of things, but from the Indigenous side of things, they were very clear that they were about protecting their own interests and ensuring that everybody else, you know, also had a share.
We've got a comment in from Neon Matouche, and I want to direct this to you, Rai. Having initiated a reconciliation project in my community, I'm concerned about the willful ignorance I've witnessed and how easy it is for some to absolve themselves of any responsibility in reconciliation. This is elementary to the work, but so difficult to break through.
Yeah, this is a complicated issue, and it's a big one. It's really one that's right at the heart of truth and reconciliation. Where we need to get to as a society is actually the understanding that we continue as a society to benefit from the destruction of the natural environment and the destruction of Indigenous cultures right now. So, you know, where this table came from, the video camera that's filming this, is all part and parcel of a very long system to liquidate natural resources, to disassociate Indigenous peoples that were standing in the way of those natural resources for the purposes of creating all sorts of wealth in this country. So the tradition lives on in Canada, and we as a society continue to benefit from the wealth that was generated from how this country was built. So that means that somehow or another, as a society, we have to understand that we have active ownership of this, and that this isn't just an Indigenous issue that happened and needs fixing, it's actually, you know, to what Cynthia was saying, it's part of a much longer trajectory that still continues and still is a system in which some people are winning and some people are losing.
But to go to Neon's comment, though, what she's saying is that there are people that just don't want to absolve themselves of any mm-hmm. responsibility for it. They say, okay, I'm sorry that happened to mm-hmm. you, but that I didn't do that. That was my grandfather, my great grandfather, whatever. Get over it, mm-hmm. right? What's your answer when you?
So yeah, we hear that it was in the past. I didn't do it. But what I'm getting at is that it's still happening right now, and that there's collective and individual responsibility for what happened in the past right now. So somehow, as a society, I think what lay underneath the calls for truth and reconciliation is the recognition that we have individual responsibilities. We have kind of organizational responsibilities or community-based responsibilities, and then there's those national responsibilities. And one of the big things that we've got to do as a society is understand those individual responsibilities. That's knowing more, understanding more, listening more, and frankly, kind of owning some more of this history, recognizing that the country that we've built today and the creature comforts that we have were made possible by the residential schools and the treaties and the destruction of indigenous peoples and languages in this country.
Eldon Yellowhorn, if I could bring you back into the conversation, if non-indigenous Canadians started to learn more about indigenous history, how do you think that this country would look different?
Well, I think it would be a bit more vibrant. You know, one of the assignments that I had with my students this past semester was, in the spirit of Canada 150, that I would teach them to have 150 Blackfoot words and phrases in their vocabulary. And so every week I would teach them a few Blackfoot words or Blackfoot phrases. And that's something I see in terms of our languages, you know, that Aboriginal languages are by and large endangered languages. Canadians can, for example, I'm in Calgary now, and there are a lot of people who can live their entire lives without ever learning one word in Blackfoot, and they live in the heart of Blackfoot country. So if we're looking at something of how Canada would look, well, it would look like a lot more people speaking native languages, and not just native people, but members of the general public being able to carry a phrase or two in Blackfoot or any other native language.
I end cross-country checkup every week by saying Jimmy Gwich, and it's interesting. We got a funny comment from one of our listeners saying, who's Jimmy Gwich? but it sparked an important conversation. For me, it's just a simple way of acknowledging our Indigenous listeners by using Anishinaabe Mohan, which I don't even speak, unfortunately, but I am starting to learn. But I do think that it's important to start to bring Indigenous languages into this country. Cynthia, there's a comment here specifically for you from Julia Winter on Facebook. Can Cynthia recommend good literature for one to read to better educate yes. themselves about treaties?
Yes, actually I can. So you send me an email, I'll send you a reading list that's all Indigenous authors, and it's all very accessible stuff, and you'll enjoy that. But I also wanted to say something about that other piece. She can contact me at my Gmail, and I'll make sure that she has before we leave.
And we'll make sure we post that on our Facebook as well for everybody.
I give a list to people all the time, because I do a lot of public education, and they always ask me that, and I want them to read. You know, as I'm teaching, I'm also giving them books that they should be looking at, that are accessible to them, and that they'll teach them something, and they're not going to be like, oh my God, I can't get through this. This is too hard. But I also wanted to say something about that other piece about what would Canada look like. I have the privilege of traveling a lot across the country and talking to a lot of people. And one thing that lots of people say to me, and these are non-native people say to me all the time, is, you know, I feel like I was robbed. That I never, you know, only in the last couple of years have I learned something about Indigenous history and Indigenous culture. And it just made my life better. It's made my life better because, you know, those people are so welcoming and warm, and, you know, it's a gentler worldview. It's inclusive. It says, you know, we're all in this together, that, you know, we share reciprocity, all those things. So, you know, it would be a better place, because when people say to me that they were robbed because they didn't know anything about our culture, that makes me feel good. And I have had students say to me, I wish I was Indigenous. And I say, why? And they say, because I don't have a culture like you guys. I don't know how to do what you do the way you do it, and I would love to be able to do that. So I think it would be a great place.
I really like Julie's question because it's a great starting point. And one I know with my students, one of the best ways to learn about Indigenous history is to go out and to meet actual Indigenous people, elders in the community. And there's no better way to learn history than one-on-one interactions. But Rye Morin, is there one book that stands out for you that might be good reading if someone wants to dip into Indigenous history?
Yeah, depending on where Julie is, there's a Treaty Relations Office both in Manitoba and in Saskatchewan. They've got a ton of great resources there. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples reports, which are available online too, are very comprehensive and are told from the Indigenous perspective. I mean, they cover it all, the relocation, dispossession, residential schools, treaties, you name it, right into the contemporary period.
Some fantastic reading for sitting on the dock in the summer, let me tell you.
The best. So a couple of resources there. I mean, the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation, nctr.ca as well. There's a lot of resources available on there, including, of course, the survivor statements and other materials collected by the TRC. So big things, just dig around. But, some of those, the really fundamental reports, TRC reports too, are great.
Everybody should read the TRC.
Absolutely.
But it can be dry. So I'd recommend personally Thomas King's Inconvenient India. Fantastic book. I'm a huge fan and a great Thomas King has a wonderful Indigenous sense of humor and so Julie that might be a good place to start too. I'm wondering when we're talking about this Canada 150 year. I've heard it a number of times at gatherings that I've been to that they're forgetting a couple zeros there when it comes to the celebrations of Confederation, and so I'm wondering if I could start off with you, Eldon. Can you tell me a little bit about what you think about the Resistance 150 movement and how that fits into our understanding of this 150 year?
My first question is what are they resisting? Are they resisting history? Are they resisting the politics of Canada? It's a story. Canada is a story like any other, and it's good to know it because it does enhance your life. You become a better person by knowing history, knowing your country that way. But also it's about knowing what was there before Canada, because there were hundreds of Native nations that were destroyed so that Canada could exist. And what's wrong with knowing about those stories, And I would say, just picking up on your last question, there's a great book called First Peoples in Canada by Alan McMillan and Eldon Yellowhorn. And if you want to read that one, that would give you a lot of information.
And we've plugged your book. Got a few more sales there. That's great, Cynthia. If I could talk to you about this notion of resistance, because it's a narrative that doesn't. On the one hand, we've been talking about treaties and all of the efforts that were made toward reconciliation, but there has been also a strong resistance in history as well. And so again, last week's episode of Story of Us talked about the Frog Lake Massacre, for example. There may not be people that know about the Tsilhqot'in War in 1864. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you think about resistance and this hashtag Resistance 150?
Well, this is a conversation that I've been engaged in as well across the country, because even the TRC, the 94 Calls to Action, Canada 150, they don't touch the communities in that are not close to urban centers. So a lot of the people in those communities said, we're kind of aware of this stuff. It really is meaningless to us, because it hasn't changed our lives in any way. RCAP didn't change our lives. It's not changing their lives, because we're not doing the kinds of things as a country that we need to do. So it's all well and fine to, celebrate the, Confederation and say, look, Canada has been a country outside of Europe for this many years, but it really doesn't have a lot of relevance. And so it's not even really, to me, resistance. It's frustration. It's frustration that people, as Yellowhorn has said, have been suffering for, it's taken us 600 years to get to this conversation. People have been suffering. And now there's a celebration by a people who came here and put in a railroad and killed a lot of people. And there's no recognition that things have not changed in those remote communities, that they're still struggling as Gwich'in people, as Innu people, as Métis people, and we need to do a better job of that kind of recognition. It's frustration, I think, more than anything.
Nelson Mandela, that great icon of the Truth and Reconciliation movement in South Africa, said that true reconciliation doesn't consist of merely forgetting the past. Rai Moran, I wonder, what role does learning history have in terms of reconciliation?
Well, it's right at the heart of reconciliation, really, because I think as we see it at the center, at least, is truth and reconciliation are absolutely two sides of the same coin. So you can't have reconciliation without the truth, because otherwise it's hollow, it's empty, and it's very likely to just be, you know, in the words of a guy like Wab Gnu, assimilation in kinder terms, you know? And the other big part on the truth, it's not just understanding what happened with residential schools, it's also understanding Indigenous perspectives and worldviews. That's where we're really going to get the shift, because if we're actually trying to reconcile inside of the Western mind or within the Western paradigm, it's also not going to work. We've actually got to change fundamentally how we see each other, how we're in relationship with one another, and what our responsibilities are to each other, to the planet, to everything, really, to all of creation. So that truth part is absolutely essential, and we have to understand both where we were, what we did. We have to have ownership over that, and that's going to be that vehicle that's going to propel us forward.
We've got a comment on Facebook from Michael Slekta. Could you also respond to the idea of how restorative justice might work, or whether it should be applied at all to the reconciliation process? What types of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit worldviews do you suggest being part of the process? Anyone want to tackle that one?
Yeah, I could think of something right off the hop. Yeah.
Go ahead, Cynthia.
Yeah.
Okay, I will. I mean, I can think of something right off the hop when it comes to restorative justice. I was out at a potlatch many years ago, and a young fellow had been in a car accident, and people had been injured. And a part of what he did was he had to go and earn some, significant amount of money. He came to the potlatch. He distributed all that resource. They did a song. He got up, he danced. His family danced, and the families of the people that were injured in the car accident danced, and the entire community got up and danced. And when that song was over, it was over. They would never speak about it again. He had restored or made restitution, and it was done. You know, in Canada, we don't do that. If you commit a crime and you get a record, that record follows you for the rest of your life. It makes it impossible for you to borrow money, to get a job, to hold your head up, to get on an airplane, to fly into the United States or anywhere else. We don't do that well. Whereas Indigenous peoples with restorative justice say, you know, we respect you as a person. We don't like the act that you just did, and you're going to have to make restoration to the family or whomever you hurt, and then it's going to be done, and we move forward. And I think that we have a lot to learn from that. In the circles that I've run with kids, they get an opportunity to get back in school. You know, they have to make restorative actions. I mean, yeah, there's a lot we could do with restorative justice. I wish we could do a comparative analysis globally of Indigenous law and show people that this Western model, it may work for some people, but I bet you if you asked even people in jail right now, they'd say, you know what, if I could get out of here and do something, you know, be forgiven, truly forgiven, and move on with my life, I've learned my lesson, let me do that, but we don't allow it. So, yeah, we got a lot to learn from Indigenous peoples, for sure.
This Facebook comment came in from Tim Vinning, and I think, Rai, you'd be great to answer this. When will June 21st finally be a statutory holiday to honour contributions of Indigenous people?
Well, I guess when it happens. That's a kind of a terrible answer, but
I don't even get to sleep in on June 21st.
No, it's a busy day, and you know, the big question is we got to start thinking about what we celebrate and how we mark our accomplishments as a society.
And just for those people who don't know, June 21st is National Aboriginal Day.
Yep. It
originally chosen because it's the day of the solstice. Yep. And so it's an important spiritual day for many traditional knowledge keepers, but it's been marked as National Aboriginal Day, and so I think was asking whether it should be a stat mm-hmm. holiday.
And what's so great about National Aboriginal Day too is that it is really about the celebration of culture. And when we talk about bringing communities together and establishing those respectful relationships that the TRC talks about, and you know, to what Cynthia was saying as well about helping non-Indigenous people in particular see the richness and the beauty and the incredible depth of Indigenous peoples, it is really important that we set time aside for that. And when we don't end up doing it, you know? So we have to make very conscious efforts in society to create space for celebration, to create space for conversations. And, you know, so long as it's not a statutory holiday, you know, people are going to kind of do it off the side of their desks.
Here's a really good question from Rose Sikkema, who sent in, and this is where history starts to bridge or bleed into the present. How does one justify reconciliation while we're still being actively oppressed under the Indian Act? So you know, if we're going back into the 1800s and the Gradual Enfranchisement Act, which turned into the what we now know as the Indian Act, what I think Rose is saying is, how can we ever be talking about reconciliation if we're still under this legislative oppression that's from the 1800s? Cynthia, you want to go?
Yeah, I think we need to move from, yes, absolutely. The Indian Act is an antiquated document. It doesn't have any relevance, and it doesn't give Indigenous peoples any authority whatsoever except over garbage and dogs. But one of the things we need to do is we need to move to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And part of the problem has been, you know, they've said, well, Canada's laws don't actually align with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Well, then change Canada's laws to accommodate something that's going to open up a very positive experience in this country, and that is going to be the influence of Indigenous peoples. It's already there. It's already present. That's why we were world keepers on peacekeepers on the world stage. United Nations Declaration, there's 2 million Indigenous peoples in this country, 33 million other people. If you want to change things to accommodate a better future and you want to get rid of the Indian Act, you need to vote in the direction of the United Nations Declaration, and whatever party, I'm not being partisan here, just make sure that you tell them that that's what they need to do to make this country move forward in a better footing.
Eldon Yellowhorn, you've talked a lot about the relationship that you have with your students and in terms of bringing them into sharing history with them. Is there a moment that has surprised you in terms of dealing with your students and when they begin to learn about Indigenous history? Is there a moment that surprised you in what it's like for them to learn about Indigenous history?
Oh, it happens just about every day, because pretty much anybody who's coming into our classes are learning new stuff every day, so it's an ongoing process, you know. I would say, too, that for many of them, they don't realize that the Native people are still very much a part of the fabric of Canada, because it has never been part of their earlier life to encounter Native people or even to talk about Native people as an academic subject. So when they come into our classes and start to learn about everything from ethnobotany, ethnozoology, to traditional knowledge in the modern world, it's all new information, and they're surprised to learn it. And I'm surprised that they're learning it, you know, at this late stage in their careers as students.
Wendy Kennedy gave us a comment. Thanks for acknowledging that there are issues with thinking only of the last 150 years. Perhaps we need a different kind of celebration in the future. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission did actually make some suggestions in that regard. Can you share that?
That's right. I mean, the TRC very specifically said that we need to set a day aside to properly commemorate the residential schools. And it also talked about setting spaces aside in the nation's capital and all provincial capitals across the country. We need to create space generally in society. You know, that's just so fundamentally important. So that means creating space inside curriculum for Indigenous voices to come in. And, you know, the hard thing is that that might mean that something also has to leave, right? I mean, if you look at how the burden that is already placed on teachers, you know, trying to get through the curriculum in classrooms right now, I mean, there's already a ton of material. So sometimes it really does mean that in order to make the change, you know, we've got to make the change by letting some things go. And that means the Indian Act. That means moving towards the UN Declaration. That means changing our laws. It means changing our minds. It means changing what we carry in our hearts.
We've still got a ton of comments that are coming in on Facebook and on cbc.ca, but I do want to start to wind the conversation down. So I've got one last question for all three of you here. I'm wondering, as we're talking about, we started off the conversation talking about the absence of Indigenous voices in so much of the narrative of Canada's history. I wonder, a question for all three of you, what gives you hope? And so if I could start with you, Cynthia.
Well, what gives me hope is the fact that people are coming out and are asking for public education. there. I mean, I get calls. I'm busy every single month with people coming and saying to me, please, would you come and talk to our church? Would you come and talk to Rotary? Would you come and talk to our students at our high school? Would you come and talk to MNR? We need to get our conservation officers on side. There's a lot of people that are very interested, and it gives me hope. It gives me pleasure to teach and you know, help people understand. And I think we're gonna do this. I think it's gonna happen. And I mean, maybe I'm optimistic under a star or something, but I think we're gonna be able to do this. And I'd like to congratulate those of you across Canada that have made an effort to come and listen tonight and are going to be listening to the rest of the shows and are going to be a part of this conversation.
Yeah, and Eldon Yellowhorn, Cynthia and I were talking, and she said she often gets this question, you know, from Canadians who come to listen to her talk, what can I do? What gives you hope, Eldon Yellowhorn, and what do you recommend that people can do if they want to engage themselves with Indigenous history?
Well, as an archaeologist, I am trained to look at the long duration of history, and Canada is only 150 years out of 15,000 years. So when we look at it in those terms, this is one small period in a very long history. And also that means that there's going to be a long future as well. And that gives us many, many opportunities to bring some parity into the story of Canada.
And Ryan Moran, I'll leave the last word to you. I remember when we were in Vancouver together at the TRC gathering, and you said something quite poignant to me. There were thousands of school children who came to the TRC national events. And I remember you saying that it's not just about the end of 4 days, but we're planting seeds. Mm-hmm. What do you feel gives you hope in the work that you're doing and when it comes to reconciliation?
Well, I think that's kind of nail on the head sort of stuff, Duncan, in that we collectively have planted a lot of seeds across the country through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and through all of the other work that's happened and is happening right now. And, you know, we are seeing the change. It is actually happening. I mean, if you look even at this little mini conversation that we have, I mean, geez, you know, host of cross-country checkup. I mean, that's a big deal. You know, an Indigenous person having a dialogue with the country. And congratulations, you know, that's really
It gets me
really
a paycheck
great.
Every week. Yeah, it's good.
You know, and we've got incredible Indigenous peoples, you know, at senior positions in universities that are speaking the truth. I mean, we're not glossing over this history. And CBC has been giving us this opportunity to have this conversation tonight, and we're having a conversation with a whole bunch of listeners that are tuning in. So this is change actually happening right now. And I think we have to celebrate that. And have we got a long ways to go? Absolutely, you know? But it's through things like this that we're doing right now and doing more of these and more of these and more of these and bringing more perspectives in, bringing the elders in, and sharing not just the perspectives, but the incredible richness of Indigenous society with Canadians, that we're going to make the change. And I am optimistic. You know, when you see the young people, and, you know, we're running this little initiative right now. It's called Imagine a Canada, and we're asking young people in schools to give us their vision of the future of this country. And my heart is so full when I leave those events, because it's little kids, it's open from kindergarten right through to post-secondary level, that are talking about residential schools, they're talking about treaties, you know, and so articulately, you know, change is going to happen. We have to be the light and the sun and the rain that lets all these little seeds grow.
Nice. What a lovely image to end on. I want to thank our digital audience. Thanks for joining us on our digital discussion. We'll be back next week for another one. But keep this conversation going online. We want to hear the topics that you'd like to see explored. The guests you want to hear from, your thoughts and your questions about Canadian history. Also, if you want to see more programs about Canada's history, check out the Canadian History section. Watch cbc.ca and on EC2 TV. We'll be back next week on Facebook and YouTube, streaming in French and English. Thanks again for joining us. And thanks again to our panel, Eldon Yellowhorn, who's an archaeologist and chair of First Nations Studies at Simon Fraser University, Cynthia Wesley Eskima, who's the Indigenous Chair on Truth and Reconciliation at Lakehead University, and Ryan Moran, who's the Director of the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. Jimmy Gwich to all of you, and thanks so much for watching.
And that brings an end to Black Lord Tribal Edition today. We'll be back next week. Gai Baragala Nundu, may God's peace be upon you through his only begotten son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Garut.